Welcome to the Everything EC podcast. I am your host, Carla Ward, and today is going to be a magical episode with Suzanne Axelson. Suzanne works as a pedagogical consultant using listening and philosophy with children as tools to improve democratic play and learning spaces. She also recently released a book called The Original Learning Approach, a new reflective practice inspired by Reggio Emilia. And if you know me, you know I'm all over that. But the main reason that Suzanne is on the podcast today is to talk about a celebration that happens every September, specifically on the Friday closest to the equinox. So I won't delay any further. Welcome to the show, Suzanne.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your journey as an educator, and what we're going to be celebrating?
I knew from childhood that I wanted to teach, but the age I wanted to teach has always constantly changed. The older I got, the older I wanted to teach, until I was old enough to work out that I didn't like the school system and I wanted to be able to teach in a way that I could see children were learning. And the early years is what allowed me to do that. So I ended up in the early years. And in Sweden, most of my education is from the UK, hence the British accent. And in 1992, I moved to Sweden. And it was technically for a year or so, but then I met my husband and got stuck here.
And here we are.
And here we are, yes. And so I worked in the early years here in Sweden, which has a very different approach than what the UK has. It is much more play. The curriculum didn't actually happen until 1998. And even when the curriculum came, it wasn't about goals that the child had to reach. It was all about goals for the educator to provide. So we have to provide situations for children to discover literacy. We have to provide opportunity for mathematics, all of these kind of things. It wasn't about making sure children could do things at certain stages. It was about us and what we had to do. And I really liked that. I'm very grateful that my early childhood experience and knowledge has been in that kind of realm.
I love that because as somebody who advocates for early childhood educators, that really allows you as an educator to own that professionalism.
Mm. Yes.
And it gives you a sense of direction, right? Because yes, it's not babysitting. You are providing these beautiful learning opportunities. Mm. I love that. But now you say that the curriculum didn't come in till 1998. So what happened there?
They changed from the social services to the education department. And we went from being called daycare to preschool.
Okay.
And it's like, I know in Canada, especially in various other countries, they're trying to make the shift to kind of legitimize it and call it preschool instead of, you know, daycare. Name doesn't make a difference. Doesn't make a difference. I think external attitudes and investment will be the same. Who comes into it is the same. How much people are paid stays the same. It doesn't change. I think what happens is it stuff gets put on pause for a while because we think we've fixed it because we called it preschool instead of daycare. We haven't. It's the work. It's what we're doing. It's a different kind of process that needs to be done. So I think sometimes the name change takes away a lot of energy that could be used in wiser situations and kind of placates instead of tackles what the real issues of early childhood is and the equality and the quality of it. Yeah.
Such a good point. And I am totally a person that will correct people and say it's childcare, not daycare. But did it matter? Did I change? Was I a different educator because you called me somebody who works in daycare versus childcare? No. So that's a very, very good point. And it does take a lot of energy that we could be using other places for sure. Very, very good. I actually had the honor of watching you speak, oh my gosh, probably 10 years ago when you came to Canada at the Courtright Center.
Yeah.
And I remember
10 years ago. No, that's not 10 years ago. It's pre-pandemic, but I think the pandemic makes everything go into a time warp.
Honestly.
I think I was in Courtright. Oh, I can't remember. I've done it twice there. I think 2016 and 2020.
Okay, it was 2016 for sure, because I wasn't teaching in 2020, I don't think. But 2016, okay, so 6 years. So you're right. The pandemic definitely warps our sense of time.
It's definitely weird.
I was like, well, I was teaching at this school at the time. And I just remember seeing the photographs of your program and just falling in love with teaching with nature, bringing children outside, but also bringing that nature element inside. And I just remember going out and buying the most insane amount of fairy lights just to bring that beauty and that magic into my program. Mm. And that's what we're here to talk about today.
Fairies.
So on the equinox, which falls around September 21st. Yeah. And I love that we're saying equinox, because depending on where you are in the world, whether it's Northern Hemisphere or Southern Hemisphere, it's going to be a different season.
Yes. Yes.
So it means that everybody all over the world can celebrate with us. And that celebration is what?
The International Fairy Tea Party to celebrate play and imagination.
I love it so much. I am so, so excited for this. I'm calling it an event and a celebration, but really it goes so much deeper than that.
Yeah. I mean, it started as a way to kind of provoke educators to think or rethink or rediscover what it is like to play with children and to enter that kind of that magic realm. Because the idea is that we get dressed up as fairies as well, and we enter this state of play without taking it over. But at the same time, I think one day a year to play with the children, to enter that kind of magicness and to believe in something maybe unbelievable, I think is important as a reminder for us of how important play is, how it equalizes, how the impossible becomes possible.
Absolutely. And I always question, at what point do adults become adults? Yes, when we turn 18, now we're adults, but I feel I was definitely not adult ready at 18, because I just had this love of play, which is why I felt a calling to early childhood education. But when I think adults versus children, sometimes I think boring, plain, unexciting. Like, nobody should ever be rushing to be an adult, right? There's books on how to adult, adulting. It's a trap, exactly. And I don't know at what point or what it is that just sucks that magic out of so many people, that light that children bring. We especially see that in play, that light and that beauty and that sincerity that children bring, because they really are the purest of just sincerity. I can't think of another word for it, but just that pureness.
If you look historically, like pre-industrial revolution and pre kind of the enlightenment, imagination and science kind of merged together so much more. And that's what, you know, play is. I remember doing philosophy sessions with my preschoolers, and I asked them the question, are fairies real? And they were having to think about it. And then one of them said, yeah, fairies are real. They're pretend real. And they all agreed. And they said, that's exactly what it is. They know that when they're playing, in their play, they're real. But when they're not at play, they're not real. So this is why we could have dialogues that were play. So we could seriously talk about fairies existing for real, because our dialogues were playful. And they could tell me about how they talked to a fairy last night, or what they were going to do when they got to the forest and meet the fairies there, because we were at play. And I think people often think play is like this kind of action where we're always doing something, but definitely conversation can be play as well. And I think that is kind of what play is, this in-between space between what's real and reason and science and logic and the impossible and the imagination, and it comes together, and the world is richer and better for it. I think, you know, the school system kind of rationalizes everything, and it all has to be scientific and proven all the time. But there's so much stuff like in the world that we can't yet. And we need imagination and that magic to help us feel good, but also to be part of the problem solving as well. Imagination is like the seed of creativity is like you create what you imagine. So it's 100% complex.
It really is. And there's visualization, but the word manifesting. So that seems to be something that keeps popping up on my social media is manifesting. And manifesting is if you can see it, if you can see yourself doing this action, it's going to come true. Well, that's grown-ups using their imagination, right? And we have to work at it. We are trying to claw our way back. We're trying to get our imagination back. And it's such a shame that so many people have lost it in the first place because it is this beautiful thing. And I tutor kindergarten to grade 12. And to me, essay writing is the most awful thing on the face of the earth. I just think it is just so formulaic. And it sucks out that critical thinking, that imagination when you are reading something, and that ability to think beyond the possible. And the school system is very logical to a fault, I think, but that's for another podcast because I could go off on the school system for hours on this one. But I'm so excited that we have, it's a shame that we're doing, like we're talking about one day. I mean, it doesn't have to be one day.
The fairy tea party with for my children, it lasted the whole year because we would prepare for it. Now that because I wanted it to be about their thinking about fairies, not what I thought fairies were, but what did they think fairies are? What is their story? What do they think they eat? What would happen at a fairy tea party? Where did fairies come from? Where do they live? What kind of forest? Because it was often the forest. They would want to go and clean up the forest, otherwise the fairies won't want to be there. They had all of these ideas, and I would ask them questions. Are you allowed to capture a fairy? And they'll go, oh, no, we can't do that. One child says, yes, we can. And it was all of these different dialogues. And then I would start using fairies to think about gender equality, ability. Like, if is a fairy still a fairy if it doesn't have wings? What makes a fairy? If you have wings, can you fly? And we were testing all of these things out. And then this would pop up throughout the year that if something happened and it was inexplicable, it was the fairies. So it wasn't, it'd happen every once in a while. The fairies would pop up and would use the fairies as a way to try and understand something they couldn't understand. Or if there was tensions in the group or something, they would use the fairies again to say, oh, maybe we just need to wave a magic wand and things would be better. And that process, so we had some magic wands stashed away, and that process of taking a time out, getting the wand out, it helped them calm and self-regulate, and then they could go back to it. So they had all of these different fairy strategies. And because we did it every year and I was with the same children, I could see how ideas evolved, how we would go back to the previous year's documentation and this is what you said last year, and you would roll around laughing and said, how did I think that? And it was really amazing to be able to do it in that way. And it became like, in the beginning, the parents of the boys were uncomfortable with the idea of boys dressing up as fairies, and I had like hundreds of photographs of fairies, boy fairies, warrior fairies, old fairies, baby fairies, ugly fairies, mean looking fairies. I had as many different kind of variations to kind of go beyond this normative view of fairies being beautiful white girls in pink tutus. So I wanted to kind of break down this normative way and say that fairies can be anything. And so the first year, some of our boys came as dragons and other things. But the second year, all of the boys had told their parents, no, this is fairies. I want to be a fairy too. So it was the boys that told their parents, no, this is for us too. And that's what I wanted. I wanted the boys to have this magic of magic potions, of flying, of being impossibly small and getting up to adventures and just breaking these stereotypes, which then they could use this processing of breaking down stereotypes to other situations in their lives where they can see stereotypes. So the fairies were actually a very safe place to examine all sorts of things in life.
No kidding. Talk about the international fairy tea party being so much more than a fairy tea party. And that is beautiful. And I'm going to post the video. But can you kind of tell us a little bit, because you've taken this international, And can you kind of tell us what you've seen different parts of the world do in celebrating?
So there's been preschools and mother groups. There have been schools as well that have been doing this. So it's all sorts of different ages. People have been doing it inside and been doing it outside. A lot of them have been using it to try and get outdoors and meet with nature and discover the miniature things. Because, and this is a lot of focus that I've been doing as well when I've been putting up stuff on the Facebook International Fairy Tea Party page. I try to put in inspiration as well. And you can see it's kind of influenced that, but a lot of people have the tea parties. Sometimes it's kind of small. They'll go for the fairy tales. They will have all the dressing up. Some of them is less dressing up and it's just a few homemade wings or something else. So there's all sorts of different levels, from those that go all out and you're thinking, oh my goodness, this is like, whoa. And this is like exactly how you would imagine a fairyland. And then there's others that are incredibly simple, and it's just a picnic blanket and some teacups on there, and the children have a few wands and they're just completely pretending. So most of it's in the imagination. And this is the whole point, that we're not supposed to be doing it the same way. I also encourage people to use the local folklore as well, so that it's not just like the idea of the British idea or the Swedish idea of fairies and elves and gnomes and trolls and things that come into it, but indigenous, like, so I have those in Australia that have been using the Aboriginal folklore into there and the small people there. And there's like, there's different cultures and different folklore. And I think it's really important to create something that is meaningful in your own context and not just do this, oh, they're doing fairies like this, to really question it. And it was also the reason why I did it on the equinox, because the equinox is, no matter where you are in the world, there are 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of darkness. So we might not be united by resources, we might not be united by what we can do, or the educational policies, or, you know, all of these different things, or language, but we are united in the play, in our imagination, and in daylight.
Oh my gosh, September cannot come fast enough. I am so excited for this. I'm already trying to think how I'm going to do it with my online students, because I don't work with children in person anymore, but there will be a way. There is 100% going to be a way.
Yes. Because I don't work at a setting anymore either. So I've gone down to my local park and just taken bubbles, and I took a big sheet out and put it on the ground with lots of paints and sprays that I put orange blossom drops in. So it smelt amazing. So I just did that, like a drop-in fairy play kind of thing. So it wasn't, and people were asking me, oh, why are we doing this? And I was wearing wings, of course. And I just explained, and the whole idea was to explain to them the importance of play, the importance of imagination, because then I would interact with the parents a lot, help them get messy, because there were a lot of parents that go, oh, is it okay that my child gets messy? And I says, oh, it's fine. This is paint will wash out. Let them do that. That's fine. That's not a problem. And it's like a lot of parental fears can come out through that way, just by being with someone who is comfortable with play to talk to them about it.
Absolutely. And I think exactly bringing people back to what once was, like, you were once a child, you once had an imagination, come back to it. It's beautiful to play as an adult. It's necessary to play as an adult.
My husband is a neuroscientist. And so when I was asking him about, you know, what is play? What's the brain doing? It's just, well, Play is the brain's way to adapt to a complex world. So we never stop playing, because we never stop adapting. But how we play will change over time, because me as an adult, I don't need to play mummies and daddies anymore or going shopping anymore, because I get to do it in real life. Yes. Maybe that's when you become an adult, when you you don't get to play the stuff that you did as a child. And I keep thinking of what that, when you said about this, when you stop being an adult, stop being a child and become an adult. And it's like, because I'm autistic, I think a lot of people thought I was like, what's in Swedish called, lille gammal, as I said, old for my years when I was younger. So I was always like a little bit adult. when I was a young child. But as I got older, it's like the two have never, they've always coexisted, kind of thing. So it's, no, I've never stopped being a child, I don't think. And most parents have often said, you know, you're part child.
And it's funny because I was the same. My mom would say, like, you came out as an adult. Mm-hmm. Because, and part of it is I'm an older sibling. I'm the oldest of all mm-hmm. my cousins, first grandchild. So mm-hmm. it was always my role to take care of the younger ones. And I loved it. I relished in it. And then I was a babysitter at 11. But because I was always taking care of children, I was able to hold on to that. Yeah. And I think I'm quite fun as an adult.
I know I was still sending letters to Santa Claus at a far too old age. But I also remember when all these big dialogues people have about, oh, shouldn't we tell the truth about Father Christmas or Santa Claus? And I'm thinking, well, no, this is part of the magic, part of the imagination. You don't have to lie to have this play.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like when my children questioned me about, is Santa real? I would say, I believe in the magic of Christmas. And then it's much more fun when we still believe in the magic.
Yeah.
And so my children would play along with it. And we all knew that yeah. we didn't, it wasn't real. But they all wanted me to keep, you know, pretending that Father Christmas came during the night and left the Christmas presents under the tree kind of thing until we stopped doing Christmas presents. We stopped and we did experiences instead.
That is so fun. So we still get, so I'm 38 years old and there is still a present under our tree from Santa mm-hmm. every year and we don't have any children, mm-hmm. but it is that magic. There is yes. that magic of Christmas. There is that feeling that comes with it. And I remember where I was because my mom was the one that told me that she's like, you know, he's not real, right? I was like, what? I was like, no, because my younger sister had stopped believing. All my friends had stopped. And I was like, I was right on that train. I was going to ride it all the way to adulthood for sure. And I still, there's something to be said about holding on to that magic.
Yeah. It's not that we deceive children, but it's like a play that we play with them.
Yeah.
And if they were to ask me outright, and like I said, I just said, I believe in the magic. And it's the same yeah. with all situations. It's like, I believe in the magic of this, like the story of it. And then it's more fun when we go along with the story. So, but I don't think lying to children is an important thing either.
No, I agree.
Or important. I don't think you should do it. But at the same time, there's certain things that we have to do where we do have to lie.
Yeah. And it's where that yes. word white lie comes in. It's yeah. just that, you know, that there's a line and you know where it is and you know when you've crossed it, I think, as an adult. And it's, what's the consequence when you burst that magical bubble? Who's feeling good here? Yeah. Because I don't think anything got accomplished.
Yeah. But it's like, is by saying these things are not real and like telling the truth.
Yes, exactly. Quotation marks.
It's like saying children are too stupid to know the difference. And yep. when I asked them the question about are they real or not, they were very clear that they understood what this was all about, that, you know, fairies are real. They're pretend real.
I love that.
They know it. They know it. They know that in play, anything is possible and anything can be real. But then there's kind of the real life too. But play and real life merge and still do for me. It means I can get terrified of things really easily. It's like I can't watch scary films because, you know, I can't sleep for weeks. That's As an sweet. Adult, I crawled along the floor because I thought someone was staring through the window and they weren't. It was just the reflection of a light. You just feel so stupid afterwards. But, you know, it's that when your imagination is really vibrant, and again, autistic people can have really vibrant imaginations. And sometimes it's better to be there than in the real world because you've got control of it. So I think it's, again, a weird thing to say that autistic people don't have imaginations. And I read it all the time in books and experts saying it. So I think it's very, this is why I really want to celebrate play and imagination and non-normative play, not just normative play, and non-normative imagination. Imagination isn't, because all three of my children are autistic too. And several times they will tell me, I don't have any imagination. I says, of course you've got imagination. Otherwise you wouldn't come up with all of these ideas that you have. They come from imagination. You do all of these, when you've played, when you've done all of these things, when, but because it's been tested, you've got to write a story about this for your Swedish lesson, as in, it would be the English lesson. They were so stressed, they couldn't come up with an idea to write it. It's like, if they told me what to write about, I could do it. But it was coming up with the idea. But that wasn't lack of imagination, that's anxiety.
I was just going to
get this confused between anxiety and having no imagination.
Yeah. I have a student that's in film school. And so I've been teaching him, well, I've been working with him since he was in preschool. And his writer's block is debilitating. He will stare at a screen for hours with nothing. And it's not the lack of imagination. It's the anxiety of, will people like it?
Yeah.
And he will tell me, he will say, like, even so, when he gets an idea out, I'll read it and he'll say, what specifically did you like? And I have to go line through line and say to him, this was very good. I would add more detail. And we go through it step by step. And he's an incredible, like, he, I know this kid's going all the way, but very much he has been told in his life that he had no imagination because he was autistic. And it has really held him back. Yes. And God love his parents because they saw that potential. And when he said he wanted to try film school, they were so supportive. And the writing that he is able to produce when he can get out of his own way sometimes is magnificent.
But I think it's because we have a very normative and restricted view of the child and of imagination and of play that it limits us. And we really think that this is what play is. And we have a description of what it looks like and what it should feel like. And yet it's more than that, because I think for especially autistic children, sometimes their play gets labeled as behavior instead of play. And so children are not allowed to access the play that their brain needs to self-regulate or learn how to self-regulate or to be able to interact with other people, because they're constantly being told that you have to, you know, walk before you can crawl. And I think a lot of, especially the autistic children and ADHD children that I've worked with, they've needed to do a lot more sensory processing issues. And their play has been a little bit younger for longer, especially very much so for my son. His play was very, very young. And his thinking and his management of his emotions were very, very young for his age. But his cognitive skills were like out there. And they didn't match. And the problem was, you know, if you were going to meet his youngness of his social skills and emotional skills, they would dumb down the lessons, and which made it boring, which he wouldn't want to do them, because what's the point? And then often people think that if we're doing these complicated lessons that he needed in the challenge, they would do it in a way that was not meeting his social skills, because, you know, you have to be older to do that. And there's this problem with, you know, certain ways of learning have with a certain social maturity, and it's not like that. This is not fairy tea party stuff, but it's essential imagination stuff.
Absolutely. And it, again, it's where play is the answer. Play is the answer every time. And if we took play to work with, you know, a cognitive question, then it'll unravel beautifully, rather than saying this is how you have to do it every single time. But why?
Yeah.
Like, that's not how things are learned. That's not how progress is made. That's how robots are made, right? But that's not how we become critical thinkers. Play is how we become critical thinkers.
There's just come some, I was just reading about some research that's just been released here in Sweden, where they've been observing how teachers scaffold children's learning and play. And that the boundary between scaffolding and controlling is a very fine line. And it's very hard. And it's something you've got to be really kind of play sensitive or child autonomy aware to be able to keep on the right side, on the scaffolding side of that line, rather than on the controlling. But I think a lot of people end up going onto the controlling side by accident. And don't realize that, you know, the language they're using, the body language that they're using is kind of controlling the situation, fear of accidents, fear of not getting to goals, all of these things will kind of influence. And again, there's this idea of play looking a certain way or being a certain way, and the child being a certain thing at certain ages, all of this will impact the way that we control rather than scaffold. Because if we're scaffolding, then we're scaffolding each child as they evolve themselves rather than this leveling up at specific times.
Yeah, and it's hard, right? It's so hard because it's not a new concept. But if you've come from the system and you want to implement this, you are trying to break your past experiences and implement this all at the same time, it can be very, very difficult. But we can start with a fairy tea party.
Exactly. And that's the whole point with the fairy tea party, was to kind of break it. That kind of, okay, let's have a pause. Let's do something different. Let's play. And hopefully afterwards, the educators can go and look at, wow, they learned this and they learned this and I did this. And I think when I organized these like full-on days where I had stations in various places with different fairy activities, and all the children, we had 40 children ages 1 to 6, and they were all free to go to whichever station. So I'd organized which teacher was doing what, and I asked them, what do you like doing? What do you think you can have? And so everyone was doing things that they enjoyed as well. And I did this both outside and inside. We did it on a really heavy rain day that we had plan B inside. But most of the time we did it in the forest. And the children would glide from activity to activity, test them out. Often in the beginning, they would take a short time to see what is there. And then they would settle into something that they really enjoyed. And all of the adults, even the ones that were very skeptical to this in the beginning, would go, that was an amazing day. There were no arguments. The children were all happy. It was easy for all the adults. They couldn't understand why it was easy, because, you know, we'd done all the work beforehand so that the children could do this. We knew what kind of things. We had people who were, we call them fairy floaters. So there was one or two of, so some people were stuck to an activity and led these activities to make sure there was enough bubbles going, or there was enough space to do it, or whatever. And then we had a couple of people that were floaters, so that if a lot of children were in one activity, they would go there and support that person. And they would make sure that all of the children were staying in this area, because there were no fences. They could go off. There was absolutely zero fences. And we had the teachers of the 1 and 2 year olds. They stayed with their groups and followed with them to make sure that they had the support that they needed. And some parents were allowed to come and join in, just one or two of them, because in September, some of the children are still being schooled in. So usually those parents come in, and all of those parents going, this is amazing. This is brilliant. So they loved it because the atmosphere is so free, and everyone, you feel the joy.
Yes.
Feel, you know, that play that has real joy. You feel it. Every single person felt the joy, because it wasn't hard work. It was flow for everyone.
And the connections that come out of that, it's, you can't even describe it, because friendships are just that little bit stronger. The relationship with the teacher is that little bit stronger. And I know exactly what you mean about that feeling, that joy. It's just, it's magical.
It is magical. It's why the fairies seem to be so appropriate, because there's like something unreal about them, but at the same time real. And
yes,
they've been in our traditions of storytelling for centuries and centuries, so that they've always kind of been there to explain the inexplicable. So it felt like a good place. And for me, again, I think girls' culture often gets put down as lower status. And it was a way of lifting this girl culture to be something that boys would enjoy and could understand. I could help the parents understand it's not for boys, it's not for girls, it's for all children. All children have the right to this kind of magic.
Yes.
So, and I think on the whole, default systems usually are that boy-like themes get done for everybody, but girl-like themes get ignored because it's not as inclusive. But we need to change that narrative so that girl themes are just as important for every channel to access.
100%. I used to do, so my first co-teacher was from England, and we used to celebrate the Queen's birthday. And we would do a tea party, and girls and boys would get all dressed up. They could wear dresses or suits. We used real teacups and saucers, never broken one ever. And it is not a girl thing. Tea parties are not just for girls. Tea parties are not just for boys. Dinosaurs are not just for boys. And we definitely need to put this more at the forethought when we're going through our planning. Not that we do theme-based anymore, people, but definitely something to think about when we are doing play and International Fairy Tea Party Day.
It's like themes. I think themes in the traditional sense where you got stuck and you did it for 6 weeks and you did that.
Yes.
But it's like themes and projects. Sometimes projects are done in the same way that themes were done. Again, it's just words, isn't it? It's not the word that's important. It's our relationship with the activities that we're providing and the children's autonomy. And the problem was the word theme then got connected with adult control of the content.
Oh, yes. Like when I say theme, I mean like the first week of September was back to school. The second week was apples. The third week was pumpkins. The fourth week, I could tell you my entire school list for most of the 2000s. So absolutely. But I mean, in that same sense, word is a word. International Fairy Tea Party has a theme. It's fairies.
It's fairies. It has a theme.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful theme.
As I said, it lasted all year sometimes. And because I was with the same I was with the same children for almost 4 years. So amazing. So the youngest child was three. So they were three when they started, and they were six when they did their last one.
Love it.
And went off to school. And it was just so amazing to see this, how they evolved and how these older ones, of course, they would then take the younger ones under their wings.
Under their wings. I love that.
and help them. And so this fairy lore kind of became ours as well. So it evolved. And I think when I was there, when you saw me at Courtright, I was there with a little fairy. And I took photographs of this little fairy doing different things in Canada. And it was sending photographs back to the children in Sweden about what they were up to. And this fairy continued to do things throughout the year, send letters, need help for, they never saw it. They only ever saw it doing photographs. And sometimes it made messes, sometimes it tidied up, sometimes it asked, I need a bed, my bed's broken. And they would solve all of these problems.
Oh my gosh, I love that so much. And it just goes to show like how far you can take an idea.
That was it. I asked my son at the time, I need a name that's neither a girl name or a boy name that you won't recognize it. So we called it Pommet, so that either boys and girls could make their own mind up as to the gender of this fairy. Yeah. And we have a word in Swedish. So we have hon for she, han for he, and hen is neither. So it's the non-binary.
Mm-hmm.
Version. So Pommet was always used with hen, this non-binary version of using it. And the children were absolutely fine. So they all knew if they were a hon or a han. So they all know if they were he's and she's. They knew that Pommet was a hen, them. So it was a way of, they used hen, this them, when they didn't know the gender. So it became a really useful way of using it, especially, you know, if you had people come in to fix the lights or the computer or the plumbing or whatever, we could use this gender neutral word so that we weren't automatically saying he is coming to fix the plumbing or he is going to do that. So the whole idea is that boys and girls can imagine themselves in all sorts of roles because we weren't assigning them a specific gender all the time. So it was never used for the children, it was used to open up possibilities.
Amazing. Absolutely love it. And I love the name Pommet.
Pommet's so cute, isn't it?
I love it. I just love it. So for people who I hope everybody listening is going to be joining us on International Fairy Day, and we're going to make sure this podcast goes out well in advance for everyone to start getting ready. Can we tag you on Instagram so that all of your followers, because
yes,
you
please.
Have a huge map of where people are celebrating.
Yes. So I have created an Instagram account for the International Fairy Tea Party now, because I realize not everyone's on Facebook anymore. So if you want to sign up onto the map, can. And in my profile on the Instagram is the link to the interactive map. And to be a part of the map, all I need is your fairy tea party name. So either your school name, your family name, or a made up name, use your imagination, and your location. And that can be really, really specific to the number and street of where you live, or the park that you're going to have it in, or just the country, because I have everything. Some people need more secrecy, but want to join in. So there's whatever suits you. And I will plot you on the map. I do all of that so that I can guarantee that there's nothing weird on that map, so that children can also go onto the map and look and see who else is on there and how close is the nearest fairy tea party, who is the furthest away from me. And we're on every single continent except Antarctica. So there really is places all over. Yep. And International Fairy Tea Party is on Facebook as well. And you can sign up there. We're doing exactly the same thing. In the comments, just leave your name and location, and I will pop you on the map. And then use the hashtag International Fairy Tea Party to share photographs and stuff afterwards, even preparation. And I will put it up in the stories and as inspiration for other people, and also to help children see this connection afterwards. Go, oh wow, they did this just like us. And it's, and this way of making everyone feel together and a sense of belonging no matter where we are in the world.
100%. I love that so much, and I will make sure that all those links are also below this podcast. And Suzanne, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you.